what editor John O'Sullivan wanted. He gave me a 1988 symposium on women in legal education, pedagogy, law, theory, and practice in the Journal of Legal Education and asked me to write about it. I didn't grasp the concept of word limit yet, so this is basically the first half. Call Me Ms., 1991. At a party on the Lower East Side last night, I happened to glance up at the video screen as it was showing a man slitting the throat of a beautiful naked woman lying face up on a table. I was in a cab headed back uptown approximately 60 seconds later, and it occurred to me, I'm pretty sure that even in her wild youth, Mother never attended parties that included video displays of women's throats being erotically slit. This naturally led me to wonder, just why is it that my generation is constantly being harangued into paying obeisance to the dazzling triumphs of the feminists? We are now more frequently raped, pimped, divorced, cheated on, and, if one's dating proclivities run toward Democrats, expected to spring for dinner. But at least no sane man would dare speak the word miss. Freedom at last. It's not just because bras burned while men fiddled that I hate the feminists. The real reason I loathe and detest feminists is that real feminists, the core group, the great thinkers of the movement, which I had until now dismissed as the invention of a frat boy on a dare, have been at the forefront in tearing down the very institutions that protect women. Monogamy, marriage, chastity, and chivalry. And surveying the wreckage, the best they have to offer is, call me Ms. No, wait, that's not entirely fair. They can also credibly lay claim to an entire complex of idiot rules that can only be explained as a pathetic effort to recapture the power women once had. But frankly, chastity, virtue, and the affectation of weakness were nuclear weapons in the area of social control. Non-sexist phraseology doesn't rise to the level of a pea shooter. Where we once had chivalry and protectiveness, feminists now promote a duty to rescue. Where the crime of seduction once protected our reputations, feminists offer only date rape. And where the concept of virtue once prevented unwanted pregnancies, they give us our precious legal right to knock off the fetus. I'd like to mention at the outset that roughly 90% of women who call themselves feminists haven't a clue what the grand wizards of the movement are up to, nor do they particularly behave like good feminists. Many do, of course, presume deep primal malevolence on the part of the male of the species, quickly take offense at courteous gestures from men, and call themselves Ms. But I have yet to meet a female who could respect any man who tries to split the check with her. We pretty much emerge from the womb with an instinctive understanding that all research and development costs fall to the male. I definitely sympathize with the impulse to ignore feminist source material. Of all the ludicrous victim groups debuting every 5 minutes in this country, rich white women from Scarsdale is responsible for more rolled eyeballs than the rest combined. Having delved into the women's white papers, I'm here to report that it's what I imagine alternating between Quaaludes and nitrous oxide would be like. And for the record, I have no actual experience with this little experiment. On one hand, you get absolutely oxidating sentences like these. People are decontextualized from the analysis, yet no one really lives an acontextual life. But then you get real howlers like, we especially attach ourselves to such categories as male/female because of our own psychological development in a culture that has made gender matter. Boy, think of all the neato articles Cosmopolitan magazine would run but for the importance our culture has placed on gender. How to weld sprockets with a socket wrench. Let me just say I am on tenterhooks awaiting the coming of this revolution. Having read the stellar compendium of feminist writings about the law, I present the following not as an account of substance abuse, but as a report on feminist legal theory. One scholarly piece on women in legal education begins cheerfully with this long self-description. Feminism is a dirty word. I never fail to be amazed at the strength of the hostility the word generates. Feminists are portrayed as bra burners, man-haters, sexist, castrators, lesbians, bitchy, demanding, aggressive, confrontational, and uncooperative, as well as overly sensitive and humorless. I would add to this that feminists are also marauding, bloodthirsty vipers, but more on that later. Considering the number of otherwise sane and apparently heterosexual men who openly call themselves feminist men, regularly employ the convoluted he or she phraseology, and will endure tongue lashings for such high crimes as opening doors for distaff ingrates, I would say this description tends toward the self-indulgent. Be that as it may, what, really, is the most open of possible minds to make of this? There is substantial ferment within the feminist community over whether a reasonably clear line can be drawn between forced sexual encounters, which should be criminalized as rape, and all mutually chosen heterosexual encounters. Of course, it would be narrow-minded stereotyping to leap to the conclusion that these girls, as it used to be phrased, wear comfortable shoes. They could just be really dumb. But even brains with improperly firing neurons could be expected to occasionally hit upon some positive aspect of heterosexuality. Not the feminist legal theorists. Heterosexuality for these gals is just another form of oppression. The heterosexist assumption is right in there with racism and sexism as an oppression that must be eradicated. Thus, one feminist law professor provides examples of classroom exercises to help us guard against the presumption of race, the presumption of class, and that one presumption that seemed to occur more than all the others, the heterosexist assumption. She delightedly describes the effect these exercises worked upon her students. By the end of the course, students were able to call each other on their own biases. Consider the following student dialogue. First student, "It isn't fair. Men never worry about birth control. I mean, don't they even care? Finally, I asked one of them, 'Why don't you ever ask?' And he said it was because he knew I wouldn't risk it. Really, how could he know? That leaves women with only two choices: take full responsibility or claim celibacy." Slight pause. Second student looks at professor before speaking. Second student, "Only two choices? Don't you want to reconsider that statement?" First student, in a defeated whisper, "The heterosexist assumption again." 38, Journal of Legal Education, March/June 1988, 169-70. One wonders if extra credit was offered to students who went whole hog and proclaimed themselves lesbians by the end of the semester. While men generically are termed patriarchs and oppressors, and feminism is described as an attempt to have access to everything men have always kept for themselves and to get this foot off our necks, gay men are described as, I quote, "friend of women." Now, I have no dispute with gay men, but I consider an evening out sorely incomplete if it does not include at least one heterosexual member of the opposite sex. And when I start thinking about these evenings out with heterosexual members of the opposite sex, I realize that the feminist legal theorists do not have my interests in mind. Dating, if not my life, is at least my hobby. So when feminists start yammering about exposing patriarchy and the ambiguous phenomenon of male domination and hierarchy, I feel I am in an authoritative position to say, huh? Are the patriarchs the ones who pay for our food and entertainment, send flowers and chocolate, and enable us to go through our entire lives without the tiresome exertion of opening a door? I hate to give the game away, but men were essentially put on earth to serve women. It was much better when everyone pretended all their little projects, philosophy, math, science, world government, and so on, were much more important than carrying on the human race. Back in the pre-lapsarian 50s, women worked if they happened to fall into the 0.01% of the population who are able to have interesting jobs, or they retired in their 20s to raise children and, incidentally, do what all serious people would like to do anyway, be a dilettante in many subjects. As far as I'm concerned, this was a division of labor nothing short of perfect. Men worked, women didn't. So when our benefactors come under attack as patriarchs and oppressors, I realize someone has to put in a kind word for the oppressors. For cocktails alone, I figure I owe the male population several thousand dollars. So I will be the one to step forward and say, to the extent one gender is oppressing the other, it's not women who should be complaining. The one solid defense feminists have to the man-hating accusation is that compared with what they think of women, their description of men is a bowl of cherries, a picnic in the sun, a day at the beach. Feminist legal theory places women somewhere around lawnmowers in the free will slash individual responsibility department. Not only can women not be expected to voice an objection to having sex with a man, the man is apparently expected to sort of intuit that his companion is not in the mood, but neither can she be expected to intervene should her boyfriend decide to beat her children to death. It is yet another unfortunate example of white male patriarchy to hold women responsible for the murder of their children, at least during the first year of the child's life. Legal doctrine that holds otherwise, that is to say, that treats women as rational beings, reveals that the doctrinal law ignores the realities of women's lives. The realities of women's lives mantra is used to excuse women from responsibility for little things, like not being able to say, "Not tonight, dear, I've got a headache," as well as bigger things, like crimes against man and God. One legal theorist writes that another example of lack of knowledge of women's lives occurs with the failure of ACT cases, and goes on to describe a woman who was convicted of assault for allowing her boyfriend to beat up her child. It may never have crossed counsel's mind to try to construct a duress or diminished capacity defense for Walden based on her fear. ID at 110 to 111. A sewer rat does better than this to protect her offspring. So why is it that the Hedda Nussbaums of the world are considered feminist heroes rather than the pitiable creatures that they are? Even if I were to concede, which I don't, that the role of the criminal defense attorney is to offer up any half-baked arguments that are beamed into his head and which he is capable of making without giggling, including the Twinkie defense, insanity pleas, and bedwetting theories, it is not clear why legal arguments in defense of women who allow their children to be beaten should be categorized as pro-woman rather than pro-criminal. Am I to consider this a great triumph for womankind because the defendant in such cases is a woman, as am I? It seems to me that by the same logic, men would be within their rights to root for rapists, all of whom are men. Feminists have become so crazed in demanding equal representation in all walks of life that this fact inevitably distresses them to the point that they will proudly cite the efforts of two or three noble, equality-seeking females who assisted rapes and thus are technically brought up on rape charges. But the idea that it would take a threat of violence to get a man to have sex is so ludicrous, I refuse to acknowledge the concept of a female rapist. In fact, maybe I should be pro-rapist because rapists and I are all part of the personhood family. The urge to have sex is at least a normal human impulse. I know of no mother not on crack who would not exert herself just a little bit, say throwing herself in front of an oncoming train, to protect her child. In the feminist worldview, women are more likely to be throwing their children in front of trains. Not to worry, though, it's just one of those realities of women's lives most women have never heard of until reading feminist legal theory, in this case, postpartum depression. Inasmuch as many women suffer depression after giving birth, feminist legal theorettes would give them pretty much a free shot at their child's life for 1 year because the doctrinal law ignores the realities of women's lives. The author described a case of a woman who was convicted of killing her 3-month-old child, explaining, "The mother, however, stated that she was depressed. Is it possible that she was suffering from postpartum depression?" ID at 109. For a more humane approach, the legal theoress cites British law, where a woman cannot be charged with the murder of her infant in the first 12 months after she gives birth, but only manslaughter, on the theory of diminished responsibility because the balance of the mother's mind was disturbed by reason of her not having fully recovered from the effect of giving birth. ID at 109 to 110. If women are so gaga insane as to be very likely to murder their offspring for 1 full year after giving birth, is it really wise to allow them to cast votes in important national elections in which the leader of the free world is chosen? Or, for that matter, in stupid, irrelevant local dog-catcher elections? If they manage to resist murdering their children during that first year, maybe we could just send them a lifetime supply of Tupperware or handsome designer luggage or something. Where did this fixation on what is a fairly unusual phenomenon come from anyway? Really, you would think the principal female hobbies were shopping, dieting, and murdering their children. Moreover, the victims aren't even our white male patriarchal oppressor friends. Their children, babies, and at the risk of pointing out the obvious, some of them are even going to be female children. Don't at least the girl babies figure into an allegedly pro-female legal movement? Have the feminists no faith that some of these pink-cheeked, cooing baby girls could blossom into dour, hateful lesbians someday? Finally, it's bad enough to think about any person reaching a point at which he is capable of viciously beating or killing a child. That there are mothers who would do that to their own flesh and blood is really disturbing. Feminist legal theorists may credit themselves with this much. They have demonstrated that there is something still worse than that, and that is privileged academics sitting in their comfortable offices thinking up Twinkie defense theories to exculpate infanticidal mothers as part of an ideological cause. O'Sullivan wrote back, in part, "Greatly simplifying, I would like to suggest that the structure of the article, which would include most of what you have, but this time on Valium, would be as follows. A. What is the purpose of the law? To create an orderly society in which people can pursue their own interests without coercion, interference, etc. B. How, in particular, does the law achieve this for women? C. From what general social and political theories do these criticisms spring? What view of men, women, children, and the relationships between the sexes do they imply? D. What legal proposals flow from such theories? What obligations would be placed on women, what lifted, etc.?" There was obviously nothing to be done. Confusing feminist legal theory with an article about the law is like confusing Plessy v. Ferguson with Sarah Ferguson, former Duchess of York and current Weight Watchers spokesman. Cigar aficionado. On the basis of a recommendation from George Will, Cigar aficionado, popularly known as Cigar, Fishing, and Auto, asked me to write a column on campaign finance reform a few years ago. This is what I submitted. This congressman bought for you by the New York Times. May 27th, 2000. I'm toying with the idea of becoming an outlaw. You would, too, if your representative in Congress were Chris Shays, Republican of the New York Times. I won't bore you with his entire tedious and pathetic career, but just for starters, Shays was one of only five Republicans to vote against the impeachment of a lying, felonious president. I'm hopping mad about it to the point that I want to commit an act of free speech against him. In a country that enshrined the right of free speech, political speech in particular, also known among constitutional cognoscenti as core First Amendment speech, this would be easy. I could take out television, radio, and newspaper ads detailing Mr. Shays' perfidy, or, if, say, I had a life, I could pay his political opponents to do it for me. But in this country, it's impossible for me to do that without becoming a lawbreaker, or, at the very least, a suspect. Even if I hire a band of lawyers to advise me on navigating the narrow legal path to engaging in core First Amendment speech, I will undoubtedly be investigated, audited, and publicly accused of being a scofflaw. In the end, I might even be found to have broken a campaign finance law or two. The catch is that the whole point of my free speech would be, in a sense, to help Mr. Shays' opponent get elected. If Mr. Shays were pumping gas somewhere, I wouldn't feel compelled to run radio ads denouncing him for his political views. I want him to lose his job as my representative. The only way for that to happen is for his opponent to win. If his opponent is Mickey Mouse, I'm for Mickey Mouse. If I were to run ads attacking Shays, those ads would inevitably help Mickey Mouse, and my free speech would be portrayed as a thinly disguised campaign contribution to the Mouse campaign. Campaign contributions, you see, are strictly limited to $2,000 per person. Otherwise, we might end up with idiots in Congress like Chris Shays. This is what happened when Texas businessman Sam Wiley ran television ads attacking John McCain just before the New York primary earlier this year. The New York Times immediately demanded an investigation by the Federal Election Commission of Mr. Wiley's subterfuge and secret sponsorship of the ads. Political speech should be left in the hands of responsible New York Times editorial writers. The Times identified such wanton free speech by a private citizen as a menace to the integrity of politics and a serious threat to the integrity of future elections. There was evidence, you see, that Mr. Wiley actually wanted McCain's opponent, George Bush, to win, and equally intriguing news that the ads were placed through an advertising agency with ties to Governor George Pataki, also believed by law enforcement officials to be a Bush supporter. So if you're tempted to engage in political speech, the only safe course is to run a wholly ineffective ad campaign that could not possibly persuade anyone to vote one way or another. Any indication, for example, that I actually want Chris Shays to lose, or any communication with his political opponents, no matter how indirect, will constitute evidence of coordination, a secret campaign contribution to his opponent. Meanwhile, let's say I don't care about my country, politics, or civic affairs. All I want to do is make porno movies. Without limitation or consultations with fancy lawyers, I could spend $1 million producing speech of the Debbie Does Dallas variety. But if I want to engage in speech of the vote against Chris Shays variety, I can only spend $2,000. It is easier to pander obscenity in this country than it is to engage in core First Amendment speech. Advocates for campaign finance reform claim they have no problem with political speech. It's just the horrifying amounts of money being spent on campaign speech that bother them. Horrifying was the technical term used by one specialist quoted in a recent Washington Post article on campaign finance reform. But saying you have a right to do something and the government is merely placing limits on how much money you can spend doing it, isn't even a clever ruse. How about this? You have a right to engage in the free exercise of your religion, but can only spend $2,000 a year on it. Otherwise, rabbis, priests, and ministers might be bought. We'll call it religion finance reform. Yes, you're saying to yourself, but no one wants to bribe a man of the cloth. What are you going to get out of it? A quick path to salvation? Pah! Congress can screw your competitors, grant you a cartel, subsidize your business, create little welfare programs for the children that will send federal booty your way, or create legal bars to people suing you. Far be it from me to quarrel with the proposition that politicians are corrupt, but first of all, no law has ever been written that could stop the citizenry from trying to get at the $1.7 trillion of taxpayer money Congress doles out every year. Indeed, the only serious and workable solution to political corruption is for politicians to be worth substantially less. Until that time, though, even stipulating that politicians are corrupt, it still does not follow that suppressing free speech will make them any less so. The theory of campaign finance reform devotees is that if Congress would further limit speech by non-news media-owning citizens, any taxpayers who want to get some of that $1.7 trillion would at least not be able to do it by engaging in speech. That's really the theory. Citizens can bribe politicians by arranging favorable cattle futures trades, selling them stocks and bonds at a loss, buying their houses above market price and selling them houses below market price, building million-dollar pantheons in their names, hiring their wives and mistresses, sending them on exotic vacations, fact-finding missions, and giving to their favorite charities. But the one way you can't bribe a politician is by engaging in free speech, at a cost of more than $2,000, saying re-elect or defeat Senator Blowhard. Of course, for bribing politicians, nothing beats owning a newspaper. Newspapers like the New York Times have absolutely no limitations on running editorials exhorting vote for Chris Shays, as that paper did, in violation of an almost uninterrupted, century-long tradition of endorsing only Democrats. Nor are there any restrictions on how often the Times can run news articles describing Chris Shays as a moderate. Indeed, assuming a favorable editorial in the New York Times were worth only as much as a half-page paid political ad in that paper, the New York Times gave Shays about $1 million in campaign donations in 1999 alone. To put this in perspective, Shays typically spends about $500,000 on his entire re-election campaign. It was a wise investment. Shays voted against almost every member of his party, but with the Times, on the not insignificant issue of a president's impeachment. Most strikingly, he repeatedly introduces campaign finance reform bills that would grant special rights to the Times and other newspapers to engage in political speech without contradiction by upstarts like Sam Wiley. I'm not saying free speech can't function as a bribe. I just think private citizens ought to be able to bribe politicians as easily as the New York Times does. Postscript. My cigar fishing and auto editor responded with a long email suggesting that instead of making the strong argument against campaign finance restrictions, I make the weak argument. To wit, I should complain that rich people can spend whatever they like on their own campaigns. It is a source of endless fascination to liberals that the rich can do things poor people can't. In retrospect, maybe it was a mistake to try to attack Bill Clinton in the pages of Cigar Aficionado. As I recall from the Star Report, Mr. Clinton has been known to enjoy a good cigar. For simplicity, Email exchanges of approximately 1 million messages are distilled to a point-by-point exchange, edited only for spelling. Cigar aficionado. Here are a few of my thoughts. Felonious implies some degree of conviction. Whatever your political leanings or mine, or the implied injustice of the impeachment proceedings, he was not convicted. Therefore, felonious becomes potentially libelous, but the jury, as they say, is still out on the lying issue. In other words, you can call a public official a liar, but to suggest he is a felon is a bit more problematic. This may be entirely a semantic issue based on the Webster's definition, but nonetheless, I'm suggesting another modifier, or just leave it at liar. Coulter. Just for the record, I do disagree that speech conventions have to follow legal conventions, innocent until proven guilty, especially in egregious and obvious cases. O.J. is innocent before the law, but he's not innocent. I know a lot of newspapers won't call him a murderer unless he's a convicted murderer, but I'm against that policy. By the way, several prominent federal judges, whose names I will give you in something other than an email, are known to refer to the president exclusively as that felon. But anyway, I'll change that. Cigar aficionado. Secondly, you rail against the rules and regs, but without neatly defining what they are or what alternative you propose. While that may be implicit, I think you need to be more explicit, probably in one paragraph, about exactly what the rules are, whether or not you're talking about soft money issue, and what exactly you mean by letting the First Amendment dictate the rules here, i.e., I can spend as much money as I have to get the candidate elected that I want without any restrictions. The piece needs a graph that concisely outlines the exact issue you are tackling here. It may fit after the graph, the times identified, with some additional transitional work in the following graph. Coulter. I'll put in a graph on the rules. I just didn't want to go over my word limit. Coulter off camera. Zzz. Cigar aficionado. Finally, I find your basic argument weakened somewhat by the New York Times angle in the second half of the story. For better or worse, from William Randolph Hearst to Arthur Sulzberger, the Fourth Estate has been granted the territory of political endorsement on its editorial pages. You can quibble with me over the use in the news pages of the word moderate to describe Shays, but in his constituency, I wouldn't be surprised to find the New York Post calling him every name under the sun on the opposing side of the ledger. Pitting individual restrictions against the established precedent of newspapers doesn't build your case. I'd find it more compelling to explore some of the inherent contradictions in the campaign financing law that, for instance, allows John Corzine and Steve Forbes to spend their millions on their own elections but not on others, thus building on the whole Wiley case in Texas. I just end up feeling that the reader shouldn't be distracted by your partisan bias against the New York Times, which is a whole other column sometime, when what you really want them to focus on is the campaign finance issue. Full disclosure here, I used to freelance for the New York Times, but I would say, blah, blah, blah. Your comments are awaited. Coulter. The NYT angle is the only edit that really goes to the heart of my argument, which is a constitutional argument, not a pragmatic argument. It's not just that the rules are inconsistent and have perverse consequences, e.g. Forbes and Perot examples, though that's certainly true, but that would be true even if we didn't have a First Amendment. My argument is that the First Amendment doesn't just apply to working journalists. The First Amendment protects speech that is robust, wide open, etc., etc., and not just speech that is robust, wide open, etc., as between competing newspapers, like The Post and The Times. The First Amendment refers to the people, not to the newspaper editors. Moreover, The NYT is my focus, not because I hate them and their speech is contrary to mine, but because they are the ones demanding campaign finance reforms that would further reduce the free speech rights of non-media citizens. It's outrageous and hypocritical for the NYT to be incessantly promoting their own special interest in denying First Amendment rights to normal citizens while pretending to be the great protector of the First Amendment. I can make that point more clearly in a couple sentences so that it's clear that this is my argument, but I'll have to go over my word limit. Cigar aficionado, Anne, don't worry too much about the word limit. I see your point about the NYT, but you do need to make that part of the argument more explicit. Otherwise, it just sounds like an anti-NYT attack. In fact, the next-to-last graph of the email puts it pretty concisely. I guess my overall point, and the way I'm justifying putting in a column that I disagree with on some basic points, is that we have been hearing way too much about the evils of campaign finance and not enough about the opposing point of let the people speak that you espouse. I want that point to come through loud and clear. After not worrying too much about the word limit through several more drafts, pointless emails, and wasted weekends, I was informed that the editors at Cigar Aficionado decided that they definitely wanted my point to come through loud and clear, just not in their magazine. In conclusion, here are some comments on my original column from two Yale law grads. Yale law grad 1, I think it's great. Yale law grad 2, my one piece of advice, make the same point in another article from a different direction. Point out that a company that wants to make a campaign contribution can make whatever contribution it wants, as long as you substitute labor union for company. And no, not those two Yale Law School graduates. We haven't been on speaking terms since I called him a lying felon. Wall Street Journal. This was the only one of the rejected columns that was not solicited by the publication. A professor read my draft and insisted I submit it to the Wall Street Journal. I said the Wall Street Journal would sooner publish Jane Mayer, hate-mongering author of the Clarence Thomas Hatchett job Strange Justice, than publish me. Then I remembered that the Journal did publish Mayer. I sent the column, and the Journal turned it down, explaining they just weren't interested in the topic. A few weeks later, they asked someone else to write about the exact same topic. It was a good article, except for one tiny detail. It overlooked the fact that the central charge against Thomas Jefferson was actually disproved by DNA evidence. Sally Does Monticello, June 21, 2001. In a terrifically humiliating episode, Pulitzer Prize-winning historian Joseph Ellis was recently exposed by the Boston Globe as an exotic Walter Mitty of the Ivory Tower. For years, he claimed he had gone to Vietnam in the 101st Airborne, had served under General William Westmoreland in Saigon, had been a rider on the Freedom Trail in Mississippi, beaten up by racist cops, and had been a high school football hero, once scoring the winning touchdown, among his other fanciful claims. None of it was true. Faced with the evidence, Ellis was forced to apologize for having let stand the assumption that he had been telling the truth. You might say Ellis had fancied himself the Thomas Jefferson of the 20th century, except that Jefferson's reputation is shot, thanks in part to Joseph Ellis. Between Nam flashbacks and Freedom Rider reunions, Ellis co-authored the groundbreaking 1998 report, Jefferson Fathered Slaves' Last Child. You might remember this report if you weren't on the moon when it was released. It was the Clinton defenders' giddiest gotcha moment. It was unveiled to instant acclaim just weeks before the House impeachment vote on William You-Know-Who Clinton's impeachment stemming from his sexual affair with an intern. As Ellis put it, It is as if Clinton had called one of the most respected character witnesses in all of U.S. history to testify that the primal urge has a most distinguished presidential pedigree. Ellis said the new testing proved, beyond any reasonable doubt, that Jefferson had a long-term sexual relationship with his mulatto slave. As author of the award-winning American Sphinx, The Character of Thomas Jefferson, and a Vietnam veteran, Ellis spoke with some authority on the matter. We're still waiting for the publication of American Liar, The Joseph Ellis Story. An editorial in the Washington Post promptly denounced Jefferson for carrying on a private sexual relationship with an inherited young slave girl, and proclaimed that having sex with slaves smacked of racism, separate and apart, evidently, from merely holding them as property. It was as if Jefferson was morally obligated to carry on exploitative relationships with Latina, Asian, and Caucasian chattel as well, just for the sake of appearances. USA Today reported, Thomas Jefferson owned lots of slaves and had lots of sex with at least one of them, Sally Hemings. According to new DNA tests, Jefferson sired at least one child, Eston, through that union and probably six others. Unfortunately for the gang of harpies defending Clinton, proof of a Jefferson-Hemings liaison was as fanciful as Professor Ellis's military service. 2 months after the report's findings had been published in every news outlet where English is spoken, a correction had to be issued. Ellis's co-author, pathologist Eugene Foster, the actual scientist, admitted to the British science journal Nature that they had not proved Thomas Jefferson fathered any children by Sally Hemings. We never proved it, Foster told the Washington Times. We never can, we never will. What they meant to say was, Jefferson could have fathered slaves' last child. And it was also not true that Jefferson met Hemings while serving in the 101st Airborne during the Vietnam War. The press was not as interested in the "we lied" correction as it had been in the original inflammatory and false charge. Less than half a dozen newspapers admitted that the report had traced the paternity of Hemings's last child to any one of several Jefferson males. Besides Jefferson, there were 25 Jefferson adult males alive when Hemings conceived her last son, seven of them at Monticello. Many scholars consider Jefferson's younger brother Randolph a more likely suspect, on account of his frequent socializing with the slaves. While Jefferson was busy entertaining prominent international visitors in the main house, Randolph would generally retire to the slave quarters. As Randolph was described by one slave, Old Master's brother, Mass Randall, was a mighty simple man, used to come out among black people, play the fiddle and dance half the night, hadn't much more sense than Isaac. Isaac was one of the slaves evidently not known for his intellectual prowess. Today we would say, he hadn't much more sense than Justice Souter. Stunningly, the Ellis study actually exonerated Jefferson on the principal charge against him. The Hemings rumor was based on two sources, the contemporaneous attacks of a political enemy and the oral history passed down through Hemings's descendants and lovingly promoted by 20th-century Clinton defenders. In 1802, muckraking alcoholic journalist James Callender, who had earlier served prison time for his particular brand of journalism, tried to blackmail Jefferson into appointing him postmaster at Richmond. When blackmail failed, Callender publicly accused Jefferson of miscegenation with Sally Hemings, or, as Callender put it, a slut as common as pavement. He wrote of Jefferson, "It is well known that the man keeps and for many years has kept as his concubine one of his slaves. Her name is Sally. The name of her eldest son is Tom. His features are said to bear a striking, though sable, resemblance to those of the president himself." Thus began the rumor of President Tom, as Callender called Jefferson's putative, illegitimate son. The oral history passed down through Hemings's children also pointed to Tom as Jefferson's child. From there, it was simply assumed that if Tom was Jefferson's son, the rest of Hemings's children were his too. Now here's the crescendo. The pre-impeachment Get Jefferson study specifically proved that Tom, at least, was not fathered by Jefferson. After testing 6 different genetic lines from President Tom, the DNA tests ruled out any Jefferson as the father. The study that allegedly proved Jefferson fathered child with slave had scientifically disproved the centerpiece of the accusation. But that wasn't the title of Professor Ellis's report, nor was it mentioned in the blanket news coverage of the report's false accusation against Jefferson. In fact, there was no news coverage, not a single article, on the amazing fact that the DNA study had actually exonerated Jefferson of fathering Tom. To repeat, the famous Tom, the Tom who got the whole reputation blackening ball rolling, was proved by DNA tests not to be fathered by any Jefferson. The pre-impeachment report had to fall back on an entirely new suspect in order to smear Jefferson. Hemings's last-born son, Eston, whose claims to paternity are far more incredible. Eston, the only Hemings child who could be tied by DNA to some Jefferson, was born in 1808 when Thomas Jefferson was 64 years old. Randolph, the Jefferson fiddling and dancing with the slaves, was 12 years younger. But more significant, Eston was conceived 5 years after Callender made his scurrilous accusation against Jefferson. In order to implicate President Jefferson, the theory must be that he waited 5 years to start engaging in the depraved conduct Callender accused him of back in 1802. Amazingly, a few years after the principal charge against Jefferson was disproved, the Thomas Jefferson Memorial Foundation issued a report purporting to acknowledge that Jefferson fathered all 6 of Hemings's illegitimate children. Katie Couric is one of the renowned historians on the board of the Monticello Foundation. Guided tours of Monticello today include the provably false information that Jefferson fathered all of Hemings's children. The Monticello Association, a group of Jefferson descendants, invited the Hemings descendants to join Jefferson family reunions at Monticello. Apparently, there are limits to oral history. For example, most people would prefer to be descendants of a former president rather than, say, descendants of his half-wit brother. If anyone ought to have recognized the possibility of self-aggrandizement in such oral histories, you'd think it would have been Professor Ellis. Good housekeeping. For about a year after each one of these happy experiences in publishing, I would refuse to waste 1 second writing anything for any publication without an ironclad promise that whatever I submitted would be published, even if it was 20 pages of All Work and No Play Makes Anne a Dull Girl. But time would pass, a new opportunity would arise, and I'd tell myself, this time it will be different. And then the same thing would happen all over again. To put it in terms comprehensible to a women's magazine editor, I was like a battered wife, clinging to a series of abusive publications. The last time was in the fall of 2003, when Good Housekeeping asked me to write about a proverb. Inasmuch as their proverbs were the kinds of sayings that make you want to kill yourself, a friend in need is a friend indeed, and the early bird catches the worm, this assignment was not exactly my cup of tea. But it was no less heinous than writing about feminist legal theory, and at least this column would be published. Or so I thought. Now that I had 3 bestsellers under my belt, I figured magazine editors were finally willing to throw caution to the wind and publish Ann Coulter. Not only that, but at about the same time I was writing my proverb column, British Good Housekeeping, ran a consumer review of vibrators. Could I say anything racier than that? Why, yes, I could. Here's the column that was too hot for good housekeeping. If you sup with the devil, use a long spoon. Fall 2003. A few years ago, when I was on radio promoting my book about the Clinton scandals, high crimes, and misdemeanors, a woman called in with the standard DNC talking point, informing me that everybody does it, to wit, all men cheat on their wives. People who say everybody does it are announcing nothing more than the implacable fact that they do it. As Edmund Burke said, he who accuses all of mankind convicts only one. But this caller didn't have the glib, vaguely contemptuous tone of the typical Clinton defender. She was on the verge of tears. The pain in this woman's voice made clear that the everybody was not her, but her spouse. I'm not clinically trained to deal with despair, but I did tell the caller that she was wrong, and she needed to start hanging with a new crowd. In fact, according to the only serious, long-term scientific study of the sexual behavior of Americans ever performed, 75% of married men and 85% of married women have never been unfaithful. John Gagnon, Robert Michael, and Stuart Michaels, The Social Organization of Sexuality, Chicago, University of Chicago Press, 1994. Never. And consider that that figure includes couples who are separated or headed toward divorce court. And further consider that residents of Manhattan and Malibu were included in the category Americans. But you can be sure that in any town, the 20% of adulterers will know one another. Alcoholics hang around alcoholics, drug addicts hang around drug addicts, liars hang around liars. Vices of a feather flock together. This is a great tip for figuring out which of your friends are liars and cheats. They are the ones who seem to know a curiously large number of people who lie and cheat. But it's also a warning to keep those friends at a distance. It's hard enough to resist temptation, the one thing Oscar Wilde said he could not resist, without also feeling like you are the only person on earth being asked to engage in the Herculean task of not committing a mortal sin. When every fiber of your being wants to do something, and the only thing stopping you is the knowledge that it would be wrong, it's not going to make it easier to know that a lot of your friends apparently do not care that it is wrong. It's especially not going to be easy if the ones who do not care seem no worse for the wear. This is part of what is so corrupting about television shows and Hollywood movies that show gorgeous people with an endless supply of witty lines and fabulous clothes engaging in wildly promiscuous behavior. Americans' friends are NBC's friends. If you think people can distinguish between TV characters and real-life friends and neighbors, consider the firestorm of indignation Dan Quayle ignited when he made the incontrovertibly true point that the scriptwriters for the fictional television character Murphy Brown were not performing a public service by portraying the heroine as having a child out of wedlock. Apparently, a lot of people believed Murphy Brown was a real person, and Dan Quayle had just cruelly insulted her. A decade later, when the writers for Friends wrote in an out-of-wedlock pregnancy for a popular character, no one made a peep. Perhaps the greater disservice of Hollywood movies is their cartoonish villains. In real life, I promise you, the devil will look more like Julia Roberts than Snidely Whiplash. Evil does not arrive with a flashing neon sign, Mephistopheles, Lucifer, Satan, for eternal damnation, apply here. Evil arrives packaged as a winsome movie about a long-legged brunette who manages to marry a rich, handsome bachelor and live happily ever after, all by turning tricks on Hollywood Boulevard. There's a reason Beelzebub is known as the Prince of Lies. Evil presents itself like a beautiful banquet. That's why Adam and Eve were tempted with a delicious-looking apple instead of a spoonful of castor oil. Satan takes the form of gorgeous actresses, successful politicians, and pop icons, cavorting across the gossip columns, subliminally exhorting the reader, "Be like me. Don't be a prude. This is how the glamorous people live." But as in Wilde's picture of Dorian Gray, the sinner's beauty conceals a soul growing uglier by the minute. People don't commit acts of great evil or great courage out of thin air. Character is developed out of a lifetime of choices. Almost every decision you make, however small, will be a step closer to God or a step closer to the devil. When you are unkind to a clumsy shop clerk, you are taking a step closer to the devil. When you snap at your mother, you are taking a step closer to the devil. When you gossip enviously about a friend, you are taking a step closer to the devil. When you go along with the in crowd and don't speak out against liars, against promiscuity, against abortion, you are taking a step closer to the devil. But it's never too late to stop and begin taking steps toward God. It's a lot easier to make that journey with companions who know the way. Postscript. Good housekeeping kept telling me to make it more personal, which was like telling a dog to make a souffle. I'm a Republican. That column is as personal as it gets. Moreover, I consider a person's view of God, right, wrong, and eternity as eminently personal. What could be more personal than that? In good housekeeping ease, personal seems to mean something involving victimhood and tragedy, or something having more to do with bodily functions. How about my secret shame, why I became a conservative, or how inappropriate touching led me to believe in elimination of the capital gains tax? Alas, I can't write magazine essays about being abused or neglected because I never had those opportunities. By contrast, Naomi Wolf has them all indexed. Sexual harassment, I got that. The curse and tragedy of being beautiful, I wrote a book about it. How awful men are, got it right here. The trauma of motherhood, hold on to your hats. My father wasn't a racist, my mother was never arrested, and my brother wasn't a cross-dresser. In other words, I come from a disadvantaged minority background. I am the product of an intact and loving family. My parents are Caucasian, native-born, English-speaking, happily married, monogamous, and self-supporting. The best word to describe my early family life would be functional. Thus, I had no one to blame but myself when I didn't succeed at something, which in turn led me to the dreaded upward spiral known as achievement. Having no one to blame, I had nothing to fall back on my whole life but my native talents. Then again, nobody ever said that life was supposed to be fair. I'm a survivor. Several months after my proverb column was rejected, I came across a good housekeeping magazine in a waiting room and immediately looked up the proverb column to see exactly what the editors meant by personal. The proverb was, "You can lead a horse to water, but you can't make him drink." The story illustrating this proverb was as follows. The author's son refused to practice his piano lessons, so the author told him he didn't have to take piano lessons anymore, and now he takes harpsichord lessons. Truth be told, that story did create a deep emotional reaction in me. Who do I sue to get that 5 minutes of my life back? At least now I know what personal means. Really, really boring. That may work for good housekeeping, but I'm afraid such columns would not make Ann Coulter the director's cut. This is Elizabeth White. We hope you've enjoyed this production of How to Talk to a Liberal, If You Must, The World According to Ann Coulter, by Ann Coulter.
And now Ann Coulter gives her take on the state of current affairs. What role does editorial opinion have in news reporting?
That's all news reporting is, editorial opinion. Yesterday, the New York Times began a new practice of running wacky conspiracy theories thought up in the editorial room on their front page. When the story about Dick Cheney's doctor being addicted to drugs broke a few weeks ago, some of my friends and I are interested in crazy left-wing conspiracy theorists, in as much as they are dominating the Democratic Party right now. And we started, you know, talking about how, hey, that would make a good conspiracy theory, that the doctor being on drugs will be used as an excuse to drop Cheney from the ticket. That was on the front page of the New York Times yesterday, a crazy conspiracy theory dreamed up by me and two of my friends just casually chatting over the telephone. That's front page news at the Times. You get more facts in my columns, which are opinion columns.
Do you think President Bush will and or should keep Dick Cheney on the ticket with him in November?
Oh, absolutely. This is the fantasy of the New York Times, that he would replace Cheney with John McCain. John McCain is beloved by one group of people, liberals. They're not voting for Bush.
Have you listened to Air America?
Is it still on the air?
Do you think it will have any impact on public opinion and on the upcoming presidential election?
Assuming, and this is a large assumption, that it is still on the air, it will probably persuade all five listeners to vote for John Kerry.
Same-sex marriage. How do you feel about it? And if it happened in your family, would you attend the wedding?
It would be an all-new definition of shotgun wedding. I'm against it.
Fahrenheit 9/11, Michael Moore's movie. Have you seen it? And would you care to comment?
No, I haven't even seen Triumph of the Will yet. I haven't gotten around to that. I mean, the thing about Centipede 9/11 or whatever it is that during the Clinton administration, there were a few, you know, offbeat, wacky groups putting out documentaries about how Bill Clinton had killed people and was dealing in drugs. I mean, personally killed people, not just, you know, by the shock and horror of having heart attacks, seeing that this horn dog was in the Oval Office. And conservatives knew about these crazy documentaries, and we never entered them at con. What is it with liberals that their nuttiest conspiracy theorists are their spokesmen now?
So you don't plan to see it?
No, I don't plan to see it.
Governor Schwarzenegger, is he doing a good job?
He's doing a good job, though not a great job. Otherwise, the California legislature would have been terminated. That hasn't happened yet. But no, he's doing a great job, considering that he's governor of an insane state that was about to fall into the ocean.
How do you feel about celebrities in public office?
Our celebrities are good and theirs aren't. And the reason for that is, I mean, it's universally true. The reason for that is, I mean, it's an industry where you don't get ahead by being anti-choice. I mean, these people caterwaul about blacklisting in the 50s. Yeah, you go out and announce in Hollywood you are an aspiring actor and you think homosexuality is wrong. See how far that gets you. So, you know, in an industry that is that Stalinistic and oppressive, anyone who emerges from that and manages to be Republican isn't just going along with the crowd. So, you know, whatever you can say about conservative Hollywood types, or whatever you can say about the liberal Hollywood types. Okay, maybe they're right. Maybe they're smart. Maybe they're better looking. But the one thing you can't say about them is that they are being courageous.
Political conventions. What do you foresee for 2008 and beyond?
We will keep having political conventions. With any luck, someday the two conventions will be the convention of the moderate Republican Party and the conservative Republican Party.
What is the purpose of the convention besides the nomination of the party's candidate?
It's PR. It gins up the grassroots. The platform committees do perform an actual function. The Democratic Party, for example, never had on its platform anti-lynching legislation when the Republican Party did. The Republican Party platform always comes out for life and so on. The Democratic Party platform is basically a way of faking out the American people. They have to come up with some way to describe their heinous positions for surrender, death, destruction, and pretend that, you know, they're pro-America. So it's mainly just an exercise for the Democrats in hiding what they actually believe. But, you know, it's good to get them on the record, force them to hammer it out.
Why don't more Americans vote?
I think a lot of Americans vote, actually. More than ought to be voting. I don't think there's anything dishonorable about not caring about politics. I think it's dishonorable to know nothing about politics and feel like you're performing some civic duty by going in like a monkey and pulling a lever for one candidate or the other. I mean, encouraging people who do not know what's going on in the world to vote would be like getting me to vote on the Oscars, having, you know, these idiots that rock the vote is always trying to go out and vote. I mean, you just randomly are sending monkeys in to pull levers.
President Bush, how is he doing, and how do you think history will view him?
Oh, as a great wartime president, as a great president. They will say he behaved like an adult with the caterwauling of irresponsible and foolish traitors and fatuous idiots, never letting it get to him, defending the country, having the vision and foresight to ensure that when he is written about someday, it will be written in English rather than Arabic.
Despite the book title, do you count any liberals among your circle of friends?
I'll never tell.
And thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you.
How to Talk to a Liberal, If You Must, The World According to Ann Coulter. Copyright 2004 by Ann Coulter. Published by arrangement with Random House Audio Publishing Group, a division of Random House, Inc. Production copyright 2004, Books on Tape.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.